Let's start with Micah here in the front.
I basically wanted to ask for more. So you've delivered and it's nice, but the 8%, and I'm kind of thinking, so you set this time last year 6 to 8. We've got today, we've got 8. And I'm just wondering, is there a chance that you might reset the plan to say maybe 7 to 9 like some of your peers, or even 8 to 10 like some other peers? So that would be my first question. And then the second question is, with all this cash coming in, and I know you're doing buybacks and stuff, but if I were CEO, I'd always be thinking, I want to buy something. Have you stopped buying anything? Have you kind of given up and said, no, this is, we're done? That's it.
So it's interesting that you only have 2 questions today. I'll try and answer them both. So on the plan, I mean, obviously there is, this question is a very normal one. If you end your first year at 8%, the upper range, but as you know, we are a prudent company, so we are now going into the second year and see what is coming, and have decided to remain at 6 to 8%. If we go into year 3 and we still see high numbers, we should have a look again. But as of now, let's stick to what we said to you last year. On the second question, it's true that cash is coming in, and I think that should always be seen as a positive sign, because we always said that cash at the holding should be somewhere around 3 billion. You've just seen from Alban that it's at the end of last year at 4 billion. We are very much focused on implementing our strategy, on delivering on those priorities, and you've seen the operating and organic machine works very well. Yes, we do look at deals here and there, but we don't spend 24 hours a day on this, and I think keeping a good balance between core focus on the operations and occasionally looking at what's out there is important, not forgetting the clear priority that we have: dividend, share buyback first, and then we can have a look if there is anything interesting coming. Let's stay at the same table, Farouk, and we have to wait for the mic.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much. Farouk Kenny from JP Morgan. So it sounded, Frederic, when you were giving your presentation, that you're basically saying high single-digit growth would not be a stretch, you know, next year. Just digging into some of the segments, so you talk about mid-market. In mid-market in P&C, is that a higher margin business for you? Because you talk about pricing still being, you know, very strong versus inflation, or stronger. So would we expect some positive mix effect if you grow more in mid-market in P&C? And similarly in employee benefits, you know, it feels like the momentum there is very strong. You've got some special skills. You know, again, is that a good mix effect? So that's question area number one. And question two for Alban is, I remember the guidance you gave in P&C about the difference between investment income and IFI. At your CMD, you talked about, I think, a 500 million hit net. Given what you've seen in markets, would you be, I mean, what are the trends that could revise that?
Good. Thank you, Farouk. I would suggest, Frederic, you start with the first question, and maybe we also let Patrick and Scott talk, because you have two people there that are very much Scott in the mid-market in the U.S., Patrick in the mid-market in Europe, that has been strong in Spain, Italy, and in the U.K., and you also are responsible for employee benefits. Patrick, and then Alban, if you could do the second question. Frederic.
So I'll start with mid-market. So as you know, we have experience on mid-market because we have big businesses in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, in Belgium, and they are excellent businesses, and we are often market leaders in these various countries. And yes, our experience is that we have on mid-market business higher margins than we have on big corporates. Now the new phase is to continue to grow on these historical countries, historical business units, and to grow the mid-market business in some other countries. And we especially have identified the US, the UK, and Southern Europe. It's a bit early to say, but Scott will comment. But first, we are absolutely on track with our plan on the top line, which means that there is appetite from brokers to have a new player on this business. And second, the first signals are that, yes, margins are higher than on the big corporate business. That's a bit early, but the first signals are positive. On EB, so we have, as I said, we have a very strong franchise. On EB, you need to be able to offer worldwide covers to big companies. I would say that on EB compared to individual protection and health, margins are pretty similar. Pretty similar because when you negotiate with these big players on EB, they have a strong procurement department, if I may say, and the negotiations are tough. But on both businesses, so be it EB, EB health, EB protection or EB pension, and individual protection and individual health, margins are fine.
So maybe let's zoom into the U.S., Scott, and then we go to Patrick on the continent and the U.K.
Yeah, just a... Is it working?
Yeah,
okay, good.
It works.
On the U.S., we've launched mid-market about a year and a half ago, and that... Similar to what Frederick said, the reason we're in the mid-market business is the large account business is a little more cyclical, so the margins can get better when the markets rock hard, but also under more pressure when it goes very, very soft. So the either ends of the marketplace, it's a little better. Mid-market for us helps is a little more less susceptible to the cycle. It still is, but the highs aren't as high, but the lows aren't as low, if you want to look at it that way. And it's adjacent to our expertise. So we've got the distribution, the underwriting talent, the capability, so it makes a ton of sense for us to be in that business adjacent to what we currently do. So we've been building it out. We're very excited by it. And as Frederick said, so far it has performed very well for us over the last 18 months. We expect to continue to build it.
Thank you, Scott. Patrick?
Yes, so in Europe, mid-market is also, in continental Europe, a very strong opportunity. It's 45% of our business. It's a growing business. It's a profitable one. We got very strong position in the UK. We got very strong position in Germany, where we are top three. We are growing that business with a very, organized go-to-market strategy that is paying off, being very close to our customer through market-facing underwriting, bringing the right expertise, strengthening also our risk engineering, and it shows in the growth of the number, and also positioning ourselves on lines and segments who are high growth. So, for instance, in Germany, we are leading position on renewables. We've been growing that book of business 15% CAGR in the outer years, and we got similar plays in the UK. So, a strong model and a growth opportunity, and we have a no drop ball strategy with Excel, where we are making sure that we're managing jointly the pipeline to serve those customers.
Yum, do you also want to say a word? Because mid-market is also key in France. And then we go to Alban.
Yes, so mid-market, good afternoon first, everyone. And mid-market is indeed a critical business for the French operation, where we are the leading insurer of French companies on the market, and where we had in 24 yet another year of solid performance, both on top-line development, mostly driven by the increase in our average price, and in the combined ratio that further improved, starting from already a very low basis. So I'm confident in the current trends, and for 25 we see exactly the same trends on the market with the same strong commercial dynamic.
Alban?
And so on investment and IFIE, so there's probably another 200 million of unwind of IFIE to come, which is in line with what we had told you last year for the full plan. I mean, overall, we would have 800 million. But so that's mechanical and that's easy to determine. We did, as I said earlier, we did better than we thought on the investment side. We thought we would get to 300 million. We got 400 million, which are there to stay, and we will probably offset at least half of the additional 200 million that are coming with additional investment income.
Dominic.
Merci. Tom O'Mahony, BNP Paribas Exane. Thanks. Just two questions for me. The first is, Frederick, you talked about reinvigorating the pensions proposition. I wonder if you might just give us another layer down on what that looks like in practice, both on the product side and the distribution side. This time last year, there was an emphasis on expanding the agency force. How is that rolling out? excuse me. The second question, just on XL. It looked like casualty is an area of growth. Curious to hear your views on the debate, I guess, in the market about whether pricing is adequate and I guess, which bits of casualty you're looking at. Thank you.
Good. Frederick, do you want to start with the first question and then also bring in Guillaume and Patrick, because you have launched in France with the Gestion Pilotée and Patrick in Italy in particular, this movement. And then, Scott, if you can take the second question around casualty and is the pricing adequate? Frederick.
So on pension, there is only one certainty, which is that pension will be the big topic for us over the next 20 years, for sure, because of the demographics. And because governments become more open on this topic. I mean, if you see the debate, and Thomas mentioned it in France today, what we call retraite par capitalisation is again on the table. So for sure, it will be a big topic. This is a market on which insurance companies compete with asset managers, and we don't have the same assets, if I may say. As I've said before, insurance companies can offer whole life annuities, which asset managers cannot. We can offer protection riders that are especially useful for pension products because, for instance, you can commit to paying the remaining premiums if somebody has died or whatever. These are regular premium products. And we can offer some kind of capital guarantees when it makes sense. So, again, it will be a harsh competition. You can offer these products in an individual way or in a collective group way, if I may say. If I look at the French example, which is a good recent example, so the Plan d'Épargne Retraite was launched 3 years ago, and I will let Guillaume comment. And at the end, insurance companies did take all the market. Now 15 million people in France have a Plan d'Épargne Retraite, and we expect to see the same trend in some other markets. So this is about having good products, having good distribution, and having a good asset management company as a partner, knowing that in pension products you can have also passive asset management.
Guillaume, Gestion Pilotée.
So maybe a word to complement first on what Frédéric just said on the retirement market in France, where we are the leader both in group retirement and in individual retirement. So in group retirement, we provide retirement solutions for companies working both on Pillar 2 and Pillar 3. And in individual retirement, it's a market that recently opened, as Frédéric indicated, and on which we are by far the leading provider. It's only Pillar 3, but with strong growth on the market. In both cases, we have a bit more than 20% market share, developing consistently over time. On top of that, the structure of the French market is leading us to also work a lot on this topic with the life insurance product, because today it's a fact that most of the French consumers are also using life insurance to prepare for their retirement and long-term savings needs. So on that market, we have in 2024 managed really to reaccelerate with very good commercial dynamics in 24, So you see that in our figures, more than 5% growth on the savings and retirement business ultimately. And there, the good news also is that we managed to reduce persistency on the existing portfolio. So lapse rate went down by approximately 1 point of percentage. So when you look at that, how did we do that? It's mostly about strength of the distribution networks, especially indeed our tied agents and salaried sales force that we did increase during 2024, a bit more than 250 additional distributors on the market. Second, revamped offers. That's where come the gestion pilotée. So it's a discretionary portfolio management solution that we provide to all customers on the market, extremely helpful with mass market and affluent customer. Of course, for high net worth individuals there, we need to put in place more wealth management solution through a dedicated team that is also working very well. And on persistency, we also worked on really training our distribution workforce in order to reduce the lapse rate that we saw in 22 and 23. All in all, it led us to strongly improve the net flows in our savings business by a bit more than 2.7 billion in 24. And all of this will drive for us future CSM release. So this year, we managed to have a growth of the CSM release of 5% when you adjust it for the in-force operation we did last year. And going forward, we see very much the same trend due to this new dynamic on the net flows. So I'm positive on the prospect of this activity. And to put that in perspective with the group figures, it's more or less half of the group savings activity. So you will see that as a material effect on our release going forward.
Patrick?
So same dynamic in Europe. Is this working? Yes, it is.
Hmm?
You can hear me. Okay, so life is back in Europe, and we are really positioning ourselves on long-term savings and pension. I'd start with the numbers. So the premiums grew 11% this year, 26% in unit-linked. And what is nice to see is that the growth is really coming from all the places in Europe. You got 7% in Switzerland, 8% in Belgium, 20% in Italy. So that's quite remarkable. I mean, 12% in UL growth in Germany. So how are we doing this? It's a little bit what Guillaume just explained. We want to be the trusted partner for the customers when it comes to their retirement. So I'll talk to a very specific, I think, good example that comes from Switzerland. In Switzerland, we are number two in individual life in the market. Our ambition is to become number one. We have a clear target segment. So clear ambition, clear target segments. We're targeting the 50-plus to capture the outflows, basically. And this segment is the one concentrating most of the wealth. So we came up this year with a new proposition, which combines accumulation and decumulation solution. Very competitive fees and a very, I'd say, simplified thematic offer on the unit link. And you saw the number. This is paying off. What is very interesting as well is we are leveraging our strong position in employee benefit. We're the leader on employee benefit protection. So through that connection, we can steer customer to a digital portal. We got 500,000 customers, potential customers, connecting to this portal where they will get advice, where they can consolidate their pension, and we leverage from this basis to move them into our savings proposition. And this is working quite well. We have similar plays organized with the same logic in Belgium, in Germany, and across the board.
Thank you, Patrick. Let's go to Scott around casualty and the pricing adequacy.
Yes, good question. The good news to start with is, when we look at our excess mainly at the excess casualty portfolio in the United States, when we look at that, we feel pretty comfortable that we're adequate in terms of reserving. As you all know, we purchased an ADC back for 19 and prior. We haven't touched that ADC, so that gives us pretty good comfort that, you know, we kind of got those years right, and we've been building on top of those years. So the good news is we think we're pretty adequate across that piece. The more challenging news is, given the litigation abuses that you're seeing in the United States, you're going to need significant rate to keep up. You know, low double digits, sort of that 10 to 12 kind of rate number, just to sort of hold serve on trend. And now we achieved that in 24, but we're laser focused on keeping that. We know what you have to do there. If you fall behind, it's going to be a problem, right, at that level of loss trend, right? So, but in terms of the portfolio we have and what we need to do, we're pretty clear-eyed on that portfolio and what we ought to get done there.
Let's go to Will. William.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm William Hawkins from KBW. The outlook for the CSM, you've talked about that, but I wonder if you could just be clearer, please. I think the plan was originally talking about north of 3% growth. I'm not sure if you're telling us that after a weak year, we're going to accelerate to be above that, so we're back at north of 3, if we assume north of 3 from here, or if we're going to be structurally lower. And within that, I'm still not quite clear. The expected unwind fell really sharply year on year, when I expect that to be quite a stable number. So if you could just help me understand that, please. And then secondly, can you just remind us the amount of Solvency II grandfather debt that's still outstanding to be dealt with, and roughly what you think the impact on the solvency may be this year from dealing with that, or maybe over the next 2 years? Thank you.
Alban, I propose you take those two questions, outlook on CSM and the outstanding amount on grandfather debt.
So the CSM fundamentally is a function of the amount of reserves that we have. And we will grow that through positive net flows, as we explained earlier. Now, when you look at our numbers, there are three things I want to mention. The operational variance that I discussed earlier, which was a positive, and that will flow through the CSM release over time. Then new business CSM, when you look at the growth there, it was a growth of 1% only, but volumes, it was meant a growth of new business CSM of 5 to 6%. But then we were down with FX because of the Japanese yen, and also because of financial assumptions still in Japan as rates went up, and therefore as its protection business, that had an impact on our CSM and our new business CSM in Japan. That will not happen every year, and again, that financial impact, we will earn it over the next years because it's discounted at a higher rate. So keep in mind that the new business CSM grew at 1%, but that's not its normal growth rate. And then the third element is the unwind, and on this, it's a function fundamentally of two things. One is simply the fact that you discount at the previous year rates that were been down, and therefore you unwind this in 24 was a bit lower than it was the year before. And the second impact, and then you need to have a PhD in CSM to, is the following. When we sold products with a lot of options and guarantees, when you unwound those options and guarantees, they didn't materialize in the real world, and that therefore meant a higher unwind in your CSM. Now we have moved to products that are that have less options and guarantees and better ROEs, and therefore when they unwind for the amount of CSM, you have less unwind. So that's the other reason why the unwind was lower, but the main reason was the first one on the discount rate. On the amount of Solvency II grandfather debt, let me come back to you. I don't have it precisely in mind, but I will give it to you.
And William, I think not to be forgotten, this is a 3-year plan, not a 1-year plan. The focus in the first year was clearly to get Germany and the UK right, which is done. You have clearly heard around vital dynamic around life and savings. So this is clear a focus area now for the remaining 2 years, and we will get to where we need to get. Let's go to Andrew, I think.
Great, thank you. Andrew Baker, Goldman Sachs. First one, just on the commercial lines margin expansion for next year, should we expect this to be outside of AXA XL, or have you turned incrementally more positive on AXA XL and the margin development there? And then secondly, are there any personal lines markets outside of the UK where you're seeing any softening in pricing? Thank you.
Frédéric, do you want to answer both questions, one on the commercial lines margin expansion outside or including XL, and then the second one, any personal lines markets outside the UK that show a bit of softening?
So I'll start on commercial lines, and Scott will help me. So first, on the non-XL business, we continue to see on the mid-market business, so the European business, price increases that are higher than claims inflation. This is very clear, and again, at the renewals on the 1st of January, this is the trend that we have seen. So on the non-XL business, we continue to see margin expansion. Scott, I'll let you on the XL business.
Yeah, we're part of the Unlock the Future three-year plan is that one of the goals for AXA XL is to sort of maintain our undiscounted current year loss ratio, right? So ex-CAT. And that we did it in 23 to 24. We did that, and it's sort of our plan. And it's all about managing the mix, right? So some of the dials will be turned, plus our growth initiatives that we talked about with mid-market and a couple of other ones. Those will come on as well, and we'll continue to obviously grow the premium. So right now our plan is essentially to continue what we said when we did the Unlock the Future.
So to your second question, simple answer. The UK is the only market where we see the prices decrease again. And I would say, on the contrary, in other markets, we continue to see good price increases. No comment.
But the good news, Frédéric, is that we have done our job. So even if prices were to decrease, we don't have to restructure anymore and could react to it.
Thank you. It's Fahad Changazi from Kepler Cheuvreux. Could I just follow up on the CSM growth? So in 2025, could you give us some color in terms of your business mix and swap rates, where the life expected return is going to go in the roll forward? And just a second thing to confirm. So in terms of the grandfathered debt, are you going to be looking to do the same thing of swapping it for senior? Thank you.
Albon, I guess those questions are for you again.
Same on the debt. So on the debt, as I said, we will look at what makes most sense for us. We will not replace one-for-one sub-debt by sub-debt, and notably in anticipation of the Solvency II revision that will give us a benefit. We will know probably more in the second half of this year. We have a better view of this, but it will be a clear positive. So we don't see a lot of, we don't see it very interesting to issue tier two and even tier one, even less tier one going forward. Bear also in mind that we will have more cash at holdco level with the sale of AXA IM. So there again, we need to take that into account when we look at the stock of debt. On the CSM, as we said, that's something that will improve progressively as we build up reserves. We're not happy with the 2%. We will look to grow in line with our plan, our CSM.
Thank
Maybe
you.
Maybe I'll add a word on solvency and debt, because you know that not only do we have a good solvency margin, but we have a Solvency II revision coming up on the 1st of January 2027. all the debates are not closed, so now we discuss with the Commission about what we call the level 2 and level 3. It will be finalized around the summer, but the probability is very high, as we know, that we will have a positive impact on our solvency margin. The debt for us and the mix between sub-debt and senior is a good way to manage our solvency margin. In other words, we are happy to have a good solvency margin, but we are not happy to have an excessively high solvency margin.
It's very different at a level of solvency of 200 and above 200 versus 9 years ago when you were around 170, 180. Let's continue there, David.
Thank you. This is David Barma from Bank of America. First, you know, on the P&C combined ratio, and sorry, another one for you, Alban. You were talking quite a bit in last year about managing the volatile parts of the combined ratio, so net cats, discounting, PYD. In the second half of this year, this changed quite a bit, and despite net cats being lower, discounting being a bit lower than expected too, you increased your PYD. Do you see that? So first, can you talk a little bit about how you're managing the three together going forward, and whether this level of PYD, so closer to the top end of what you used to do, is what we should expect going forward? And then secondly, on capital return and the AXA IM related buyback, the way I understood the 3.8 was that it was based on the share price at the time of the transaction in last summer. Your share price has increased since then, so but you're still talking about 3.8 billion today. Which one of the two is it? Thank you.
3.8 billion. Alban.
Yes, so on the PYDs, I did say that effectively we would try as much as possible to manage together discount PYDs and NatCat. That being said, you also need to recognize the fact when you look at your reserves and when you have your actuaries say, well, we have some excess reserves. I'm not seeing 1.1 versus 1.6, 23 versus 24, as a big difference, and 1.6 is a reasonable amount. I think we still have prudent reserving. For instance, we didn't release any reserves at Excel. So going forward, that there can be some variations around that that level of PYDs. But again, it's first and foremost a testament to our prudent reserving. On capital release and the 3.8 billion, the way we think about it is simple. It's 400 million of earnings, as you saw. It's a P of 9.5 times. So when you multiply one by the other, you come to the 3.8 billion of share buyback that's needed to offset the dilution of earnings.
Let's go to the table over there. Hadley, I think.
Thanks very much, Hadley Cohen, Morgan Stanley. First question, if I could ask one of Michael's questions in a slightly different way, please, around... You know, there's a lot of positive talk here around momentum in the top line. You've fixed the problems in the UK and Germany in terms of you should start seeing net customer growth. There is still margin expansion coming through on the life side, on the P&C side, on the health side. We should get a bit of a recovery in the CSM growth. There's no incremental drag from holding expenses, no incremental drag from tax as well. So I guess the point, my question is, why shouldn't we expect 8% or more earnings growth in 2025 versus 24? That's my first question. Second question is just a bit of clarity, please, around the timings of the buybacks. So you've announced the 1.2 billion today, and I think you've got until the end of the year to complete it, but presumably that needs to be completed before you start doing the 3.8 billion. And I think the deal is expected to close at the end of the second quarter, and presumably you want to start doing that the subsequent buyback as quickly as possible. Can you just talk me through how we should think about the timings of this, and is it reasonable to assume that all of this could be done before we're back here this time next year and you're proposing the next buyback? Thank you.
You're projecting very far in the next year. So I think, Alban, you talk about the question of buybacks, and I'll try a second time your first question. But I think on the buybacks, Alban has been quite clear. The 3.8 will be done post-closing. The closing will most likely be in summer, and there's half of it this year and the other half next year, roughly. So I would probably not expect at the end of February to be done with it, but Alban will go more into detail. On the first topic, you are absolutely right that there is great momentum in the business model of AXA. Nevertheless, we still have got a couple jobs to do. In the first year, we focus very much on fixing Germany and the UK. This is done and is behind us, and the teams have all done a great job on this one. We still have work to do, as we mentioned earlier, around the margin expansion, a bit in P&C, in health, and certainly work more on the dynamic around our life business. And therefore, we would like, in the second year of the plan, see more of this happening before we have a debate, is 6 to 8 the right number? And that's why I have adapted to be a very French over 9 years, but the German prudency is not out yet, and so I will remain on these 6 to 8% for the time. Alban.
So the fact that we said it would be done before year-end, that's a prudent legal language, let's put it that way. The experience is that in previous buybacks, we could buy, say, 150 million a week. So that gives you the idea that fundamentally we should be done with the 1.2 billion buyback before we start. Now, I want to make sure that my lawyers are happy with that. I would still want to be prudent. It depends on market condition and so on. But normally we should be done before we start the XIM buyback.
Will.
Thanks. Will Hardcastle, UBS. Really quick one on the grandfather debt. There's been a few on that, hasn't there? Just presumably, just working out, is that in the logic, in the plan on the EPS, that you know, there'd be a reduction there? I guess it will be on solvency and leverage, but just wondering if there's any thought process in the target plan EPS on that already. And the second one's just really thinking about the dividends. We've seen the odd change of announcement on timings of dividends by some European and French domiciled businesses, financial services businesses. Is there anything structurally that makes you have to have an annual dividend, or is this something that the board considered this year? Thank you.
So thank you, Will. Alban, you take the first question. I'll do the second one because it's a quick answer. Obviously, the board is looking at this on a regular manner, and since some of our French other companies have gone to this, we obviously had a look at it, and weighing all options, the board has decided to stay at the current policy of a yearly dividend. Alban.
So in the meantime, thanks to Anu, I have the answer on the grandfather debt. So it's 4.5 billion left, 3.4 in tier 1 and 1.1 in tier 2. As we said last year, we will not necessarily repay everything, because some can become senior debt, and we'd be happy with that. So again, that's something that we can consider. Look, again, we have a Solvency II revision. We have AXA IM that allows us to manage our debt slightly more freely than what we could think probably a year ago. So yes, there's potentially a bit of upside there, but it's not massive, honestly.
Good. Let's go to the front row.
Thank you. Ria Shah, Deutsche Bank. So two questions. The first, just on Excel. In the slide, it showed that the retention has been increasing over time. So if you could just talk about the actions you've been taking to improve it and if that could continue to improve in 25-26. And then the second question is around the, it's just a clarification around the commission ratio, within a P&C combined ratio. Should we expect this to change any more going forwards because of business mix?
So, Scott, do you want to start on the first one and then Alban on the second one, knowing obviously that when you go into more attractive businesses, automatically your commission will increase. But Alban will go into detail. Scott.
You're just on the retention. That has been a deliberate part of our strategy. A couple of years ago, we were in a fixing part of the portfolio, right? So there was some terms and conditions we had to fix. Pricing wasn't quite where we wanted it to be on some of the product lines. So by definition, we ended up with a little bit lower retention. For the last couple of years, we really like the book of business. We like the adequacy of the pricing. So we've been laser focused on retention of the portfolio. And we do it a couple of ways. We've implemented rather than just an individual product, we also have client managers now who meet with clients directly and speak about the various products we provide and the services we provide to help them see sort of the overall AXA, one AXA approach. What that goal is to make AXA smaller for the client. So rather than them trying to figure us out, we make it simpler for them to do business with us. And that has actually given us an uplift, not just on additional business with that client, but retaining that business. And there's been also, the last few years, things have been a little, there's lots going on between CAT and other, poly crises happening, and sort of a little bit of a flight to quality. And our financial strength really plays into that over the last few years, where clients are looking for that stability. And that's been a very strong value proposition for us on the renewal book.
And on your second question, the short answer is no, we don't expect an additional increase. And just to clarify, we are not willing to pay more commissions for a given business. So it is a question, as we said, of business mix. The business mix issue is more an Excel issue because we want to adapt to the various cycles of the various lines of business. But we don't see the cycle in 25 to be massively different from what it was in 24 when it comes to property, casualty, or financial lines. That's why we think the acquisition ratio should be fairly stable.
Let's go in the corner there, and then we go to Andrew.
Afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. It's Abid Hussein from Panmure Liberum. I've just got one question left on the health business, if I can. How are the margins trending across the health insurance business, and do you still see avenues for growth following the step change that we saw since COVID? Any additional color on the health business by geography would be useful. Thank you.
Very good. Frederic, do you want to talk about it, knowing that we have focused...
Maybe Patrick.
Oh, Patrick, yeah, exactly. We have focused in 2024 very much on getting the UK on track, which Patrick and his team have done. And so, Patrick, maybe you talk about the other geographies, knowing that there is still some potential left to do more.
Yes. So I would start by saying we are quite pleased with the performance we got on health this year. We increased earning by 24%. And to make things simple, roughly two-thirds of this is the UK turnaround, and a third is coming from other geographies. So we got very strong performance in a number of markets. France earnings are going up double digit. It's the same in our international market. We got some other European markets that perform very well at double digit growth. So we believe we have leeway in our margins on health from basically two factors. The first one is everything we have been doing on the health front in the UK will have its full impact, and will the price increase we're all through the claims programs that we've led will have full impact this year. So I give you one example. We've increased our steering towards our preferred networks in the UK from 40% beginning of last year to close to 80%. This is a lot of value attached to that, and this will be fully embedded. So pricing earning through, new pricing increase to follow the inflation, and business much stronger. And it's a big chunk of our business. And then there's another thing which is very encouraging for us, and that is reflected in those numbers, which is, as you know, we've organized ourselves differently on health. We've put together a global health unit that is managing this portfolio in a global manner. And that is basically specializing far more all of our entities and upskilling in particular on the technical front. So what are we doing there very specifically? Well, we're leveraging our scale. You must know that we are a leader outside of the U.S. when it comes to health, certainly when it comes to EB. What does this give us? It gives us, first and foremostly, global data sets. So we're putting the power of this data in improving the risk selection and leveraging that. That's number one. The second thing you must know about us is that we have developed proprietary technology, proprietary tools that we implement across all of our countries and two fronts. One is automated renewal portfolios, so far more sophisticated way and automated way to drive renewal at a very granular level. So you are able to chunk your portfolio and be extremely specific account by account. Another one, a good example, is what we're doing on fraud, waste, and abuse. I would add one last thing that ties to the UK, actually. We've worked on the UK on pathway management. We acquired a company last year in the UK that does pathway management. Pathway management, in simple terms, it's fundamentally implementing medical protocols that are doing two things: a better outcome for the customers and a cost reduction ultimately. There's a lot of science and data behind that, and we plan to roll out what we have now in the UK, and it's proven creating a lot of value in other countries.
Thank you, Patrick. We do two more questions. Andrew, and then
Mike. Hello, it's Andrew Crean, it's Autonomous. Could I ask actually three questions? Firstly, what's the benefit of lower reinsurance costs in terms of your combined ratio, 25 over 24? Secondly, all the shenanigans going on in Italy with your distribution partner and everyone else, could you give us a quick teaching as to what your opportunities, threats, and plan Bs are? And then thirdly, you say that your commercial lines business is stable, but if I look at the second half combined ratio, X undiscounted, XPYG, XCAT, 93.6. It's 140 basis points worse than the first half and 50 basis points worse than the second half of 23. That doesn't look stable to me.
Good. Thank you, Andrew, for three questions. The benefit of lower reinsurance cost, Frederick, if you could do that question. I'll do the Italy one, and if Alban could do the third one. Maybe let me start with Italy. What is quite interesting, Andrew, is that our joint venture partner has gone through a lot of different terms of stormy waters. But when you look at the performance, and Patrick can go into detail, it actually is going quite well. We are growing very well with BMPS. It's a partnership that has been going on for a long time, that will come to a point of either end or renewal in 2027, and we are doing everything we can to continue this partnership, and it has worked well again through different stormy phases. I'm not going into speculation what will happen in Italy, because the landscape of different alliances is very complex. Therefore, let's wait and see what's happened, and let's not lose focus operationally on continuing to performing well on this partnership. Frederick.
On reinsurance. Ceded reinsurance for us is a huge lever. We cede 2.7 billion result every year to our reinsurers, to our partners. Of course, we have a benefit because we require less capital. But this is a big amount. So there is a big lever for us if reinsurance costs are decreasing. We've seen on CAT, for instance, that reinsurance costs have decreased by somewhere between 5 and 10% at the 1st of January this year. So for sure, on our primary insurance business, it has a positive impact. You could argue that we also have a reinsurance company with AXA XL Re, so that there is a partial hedge between the two, which is true.
Alban, commercial and business stable, yes or no?
Yeah, sorry, Andrew. Can you say again the numbers that you are referring to? Because I...
PYD.
If you strip out PYD, CAT is the Andrew says it's 140 basis points worse. Is that true? Yes or no?
So if you compare H2 to H2, you will not see such a difference. But the question is obviously at the end of the year. That's the moment we look at our reserves. We do that twice a year, but we do it more formally in the second half. And that's the moment where when we look at our reserving, and as I said, we want to have a prudent reserving. So you shouldn't look into that with more. There's no trend, and you shouldn't think of H2 24 as being the basis for the loss ratio of 25.
Michael, last question.
The same as Andrew, but maybe you can make it even more clear. How do we calculate how much your excess reserves have gone up? I think you kind of gave us some guidance on this. And the other one is a really silly one, is AI. You said the costs were high this year. What's the benefit of them not increasing next year? That's it.
Good. First question, Alban, and second question, Frédéric.
So on excess reserves, that's the silly thing about IFRS 17. We have to say it's the best estimate, and we can't say that there is an identified amount of excess reserves. Nevertheless, we are prudent. That's the way I would put it.
Michael, your question on AI?
Specifically
on what?
Last year.
So the benefits on AI first are on various areas. I said we will see some benefits on the technical result. We will see some benefits on pricing and underwriting. We will see some benefit on claims. We will see some benefits on productivity and costs. And there is an impact on the customer experience. These are the big pillars of our programs. It is fair to say that for the time being, with all the use cases we have and so on, we haven't seen yet significant impact on our P&L. And I think this is the challenge that we have over the next 2 years of the plan and over the 3 years of the next plan, which is to make sure that what works, we are able to scale it up and see really impact on the P&L. And today, and I think many companies are in the same situation, we are testing, we are experimenting, we are piloting. But if you ask me, have you seen big benefits? Not yet. We know enough to believe that there will be benefits, but we haven't seen big benefits yet on our P&L.
And Michael, AI, I would say, is more a cultural challenge than a technical challenge. Because putting the machines right is easy. Making people come up with ideas and apply it is probably the more challenging one. And so we went on a journey which was relatively simple. We gave everybody access to AI through a secure GPT so that they were in a safe environment, being able to test things out. We also taught them how to prompt and so on. We then went into an area where we said, look, launch many, many projects and pilots and see what could work and not. And we are at a point now where we say, look, we've seen what works and what doesn't work. Let's now focus on three areas, pricing and underwriting, claims and customer experience. And let's scale in these areas because we have seen, and you can afterwards talk in particular to Patrick, Scott and Guillaume, where they have seen areas where we can really scale. And we are at this point now, and I would rather go a controlled journey than spending too much and never see any benefits except the cost. Thank you very much for all your questions. Thanks for listening to us, and we wish you a great rest of the afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.